The first case this afternoon on the Southern Panel's calendar is case number 83314. Marlon Brown, is that correct pronunciation?
Yes.
Versus Brian Williams, the warden. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Okay, go ahead. And I don't want to mispronounce your name, so I'm going to have you announce it first.
Yes, Your Honor, it's Michael McAwill. So it's good to look at that as two names. I use between the first one, McAwill, which is McAwill from X-Men, and Amaya is the second name.
Cool. It's a really cool name. I like that. All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. So my name is Michael McAwill. I am the attorney for Bell. May I please report? I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Appellant's petition for habeas corpus was not successful because all orders on prior petitions in this case are void due to the trial court's voluntary refusal for 45 months on July 19, 2019. The crux of this case is that the senior judge denied Marlon's petition as successful, despite all prior orders on the supposed prior petitions being void. It is undisputed that the trial court recused herself from this case on July 19, 2019.
So, counsel, what do we do then with the record so difficult here to some extent? What do we do with the unrecusal? So are we talking about the period from the recusal to the unrecusal, or is everything void there, but then we have to deal with how it affects subsequent petitions, or is it your position that you can't unrecuse? What do you got going?
Yes, it is our position that you cannot unrecuse. This rule is 100 years of Nevada's precedent, that once a judge recuses,
they cannot re-enter the case and enter rulings on the merit. And if they do, all subsequent orders are not simply voidable, they are void.
So what authority do you have for that proposition? That here, where at least it's alleged from the paperwork, that I can glean, that it was entered in error. So let's say this recusal, let's take the unrecusal from Judge Villani at its word. It was entered in error. Then they cannot see it on that case at all? Like, what authority do you have for that proposition?
Well, this court acknowledged in the Whitehead case, Whitehead v. Commission on Judicial Discipline, that every single appellate court that has ever addressed this issue of a judge re-entering a case after recusal has held that any order on the merits is void. This is because it is constitutionally intolerable to allow a judge to reenter a case after entering a voluntary recusal order, because the motivation for reentering the case could stem from that bias if it existed. And it is equally likely that that could be the actual reason why they are reentering the case, rather than just it was a mistake. Every single court that has ever addressed that issue has concluded that it is constitutionally intolerable, even if it was based on a mistake.
Okay, do you have a case for that? They say other than Whitehead, what do you have for me?
Yes, it's Whitehead, and Whitehead outlines every single court that has ever addressed this issue. And then in addition, there is this court's rulings and all prior rulings stating that the judge cannot reenter. The only time that the court has ever allowed a lower court to re-enter a case is when this court reviews that decision on merits and decides that the recusal was an error. This did not happen here. That's the case that the state decided, the city of Las Vegas, the redevelopment agency. In that case, one of the parties appealed on mandamus. This court accepted mandamus review, determined that the recusal was an error, and then allowed the lower court judge to re-enter the case. But the judge remained recused per the law until this court made that decision. And this case here, the court did not accept mandamus review of the lower court's recusal order. This court did not conclude that the recusal was an error. This court did not direct the trial court judge to re-enter the case. City of Las Vegas is inapplicable.
But you're kind of dealing with situations like in the case you're referring to, with Judge Denton, where Judge Denton made a finding that he thought there was a conflict that he needed to recuse. And the Supreme Court ultimately came in and said, no, he didn't need to recuse. I think that the question that we have here, and what I think, and I apologize, I don't mean to reword what Justice Sigelich was asking, but if the judge never had an indication that there was a conflict, i.e., it was in error that an order was entered recusing that judge, you still think that that judge is recused from being able to preside in the case?
Yes. Again, that is because of the risk of the actual motivation for reentering the case being stemming from the conflict is too great to allow them to reenter after the recusal. I would note that in this particular case, the trial judge recused also from the criminal case. So there's not just one recusal, there was two recusals in this matter. And so because of that, is it possible to tell that this was just an error when she is admitting one recusal in the underlying criminal case that this case stems from was proper? I would also note that we have already had another court review this particular, the recusals in this case, in another case that our firm was involved in, and the chief judge of the 8th Judicial District Court just disqualified Judge Levitt, finding that those recusals are still valid. And I would note that that recusal order has not been rescinded. There has not been any rescinding of that order. The judge that reassigned the case to her is the judge presiding over the criminal docket. The judge who presides over the criminal docket has no right of review of a judge that sits at an equal level because they are a district court judge. So he has no power to review the recusal order and overturn it. And so he simply just reassigned the case to the recused judge. And I would note that Judge Levitt has not rescinded that order at any time thereafter. Instead, she just didn't serve those orders on my client, which also is an issue of notice to my client of this issue. My client also filed a motion to disqualify her, and she included in an affidavit that she had recused from the first case, but not this case, essentially concealing that issue from the reviewing judge who reviewed that motion to disqualify. So, and these issues, go ahead, yes, Your Honor.
So I just want to kind of cabinet, but first I want to ask, you said you're saying we can unrecuse somebody, but they can't unrecuse themselves. So first question, what about in the example of an actual undisputed error? I say, oh, it's John Doe. I can't do John Doe's cases, whatever. I have an actual bias, and they file it, and then they find out it's the wrong John Doe. It's a different John Doe. Can they unrecuse on that?
The law says that they cannot.
Okay, you're saying no. Okay, and then if we, just for purposes of argument here, if we were to find that they could, I don't know, but if we were to find that they could, so you have the unrecusal, what effect does that period have, that period of voidable or void actions have on where we are procedurally now? We're on third habeas. That would be during the time of the first habeas orders. Talk to me about that.
So with regards to that issue, thank you for the question. I would note that, number one, that first order that was on that first petition was filed while the case was not even reassigned to Judge Levitt. She entered it before the reassignment. So she was not even the judge on the case when she entered that order. And if you later conclude that she could re-enter the case, the way the law works is you direct her to re-enter. That does not retroactively validate all the prior rulings in the case. All of those rulings still remain void. It just means that she could now re-enter the case and enter rulings after you decide that the recusal was an error. And so the law still remains that all prior orders of a recused judge remain void until the Supreme Court reviews it and determines that it was an error and then decides that she can re-enter the case. I would like to move now on the issue of procedural bars. Assuming, Aguendo, that the trial court's orders were not void, which they were, the senior judge still should have held an evidentiary hearing.
But before we get to that, and I apologize, let me go back to one question I have about the recusal issue, and that's waiver. So the recusal gets entered in July of 2019. The order gets signed in August, which, as I understand, and I don't disagree, that at that point in time, it appeared the case was in Judge Villani or Judge Miley's department before Judge Villani assigned it back. The written order gets entered. The appeal goes up on for the appeal of the post-conviction decision by the judge. Court of Appeals issues a decision on that. All these things occur for many, many years until November 3rd of 2020 when you file the current petition in this case, which brings up the issue of, hey, the judge was recused. At what point is there an argument that you've waived that issue? Because had it been raised when it was originally occurring, could have vacated the order, judge signs a new order, Judge Miley signs an order, because the wisdom of the decision occurred when the non-recusal was in place. The written order, I understand, was signed afterwards.
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. That's a very good question. And I think it also relates to the issue that it relates to the issue of the good cause for hearing the petition even if the orders were not void. And that is, the evidence was not available to my client to make this challenge. So he cannot waive something he does not know about. He was proceeding pro se in this habeas case. He was never served with the recusal order, minute order. He was never served with the reassignment minute order either. And so he had no reason to know that this was an issue. Instead, he filed a motion to disqualify Judge Leavitt in this case for the recusal order in the criminal case.
But he still had an attorney throughout this that was proceeding parallel on his direct appeal in the criminal conviction. So I understand that you're saying, well, my client may not have known about this recusal issue, but his attorneys knew about it.
His attorneys did not know about it because those minute orders were not served on his direct appeal attorney either, because the direct appeal attorney was not proceeding in the habeas case. The minute orders relating to this recusal were never served on his other attorneys. They were never served on him. He had absolutely no way to know of this until we got involved and we started looking up the record and we found this additional recusal order. We were under the impression that she had only recused from the criminal case until we found this order. There's also,
When did you become under the belief that she recused only on the criminal case?
When we first obtained the case, okay, we had known this because he had filed the motion to disqualify, okay, Judge Leavitt in this case,
okay,
based on the same bias argument that was raised on the direct appeal that she moved to strike.
Okay.
In that case, she issued a sworn affidavit, right, that she had recused from the criminal case, but that she was impartial in this case, failing to inform the reviewing judge and my client that the recusal had happened in this case. So at the time, him proceeding pro se.
So, and I apologize, but I'm confused. What is it that leads you to believe there was a separate order that she recused in this case, quote unquote, meaning the appellate case?
Because as we began reviewing the habeas case, we found the minute order. As we're looking through the record, we downloaded all of the orders and eventually came across this recusal order on the July 19th, which was different than the recusal order on August 2nd of 2019, which was after the prior appellate counsel had issued the non-opposition in the district court case. And so with regards to waiver, as I said, and with regards to the good cause issue, you cannot waive something if you had no reason to know about it. And my client had absolutely no way of knowing that this had occurred. And the record of his filings in this case indicate that he absolutely did not know that this occurred until we were retained as counsel,
okay,
which is after both the first petition and the second petition. In addition to that, there's a litany of other evidence that occurred after the fact. I would like to stress as well the bias issue, the judicial bias issue, external source of judicial bias issue, was raised in the direct appeal. It was not reviewed by this court because the trial court moved to strike that issue personally. Then afterwards, reviewing the same argument in the second petition, she then denied review of that issue. So she caused this court to not be able to review it on direct appeal and then ruled that it was successive in the later appeal after he was aware of the situation and what the attorney had actually argued. And so because of that, that's another issue that is outside entirely of his control. The judge in the lower court striking, moving to strike personally to strike that argument and then deciding to not review it when he raised it on the, in the later petition. In addition to that, you have the issue of the judge not, the issue of the judge not, not telling the reviewing court on the motion to dismiss that she had recused. You have the issue of the judge's brother filing the bar complaints against myself and my firm, were admitting that a number of the allegations that were in the, that were made in that motion to strike were actually false. She said that all of those allegations were false. And then the brother admitted most of that stuff was true, which supported that bias allegation, which should go forward and be reviewed. In addition, I would also like to notify the court that three separate district court judges now have reviewed the issue of the unlawful surrender of the bond and have ruled based on evidence that was not disclosed to my client during the criminal case that the bond was unlawfully surrendered in violation of Nevada law. One of those cases just recently came out after the briefing in this case was concluded. And these three cases make it substantially likely that any reviewing court after this in an evidentiary hearing cannot find anything other than the bond being surrendered unlawfully and in violation of his Fourth Amendment rights, which then spawned all the other constitutional violations, his inability to retain counsel of choice, his receiving a public defender that proceeded with a defense that he was, you know, fundamentally against, which is a structural, both of which are structural errors. That particular issue, underlying issue, the evidence for that was not available until January of 2020, when the Department of Insurance filed its administrative record in that appeal by the bond agent. At that point, that became public record, and all the evidence that should have been disclosed in the criminal case was then in the public record where he could then see it. And so for these reasons, there is good cause. And when you take a look at the judgments of these lower courts on that bond issue, absolutely it is prejudiced that he did not receive that evidence, because had he had that evidence, a reviewing court could come to no other conclusion, as three separate tribunals have already concluded, that surrender of the bond was unlawful without good cause and thus without probable cause. I'm going to stop now just to ensure that I have some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Actually, Mr. McAvoy-Amaya, you have exceeded your time.
I will give you
1 minute for rebuttal and add a minute to Mr. Chin's time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. Alexander Chen on behalf of the respondent, State of Nevada. I think this case can best be summed up by no good deed goes unpunished. And the reason that I say that is because this district court took the case voluntarily or was assigned, but it wasn't the original court. It did its job. It volunteered to take somebody else's case for actions that took back all the way back in 2014. In doing its job, it's now been subjected not only to the petitions that have been filed, to the appeal that was filed and withdrawn by Mr. Mueller, but by other personal attacks which have no basis in fact, absolutely none. And I understand as a public figure and as a judge, there's some criticism perhaps about one's decision, but I can't imagine what it's like to have your own daughter subjected to this type of scrutiny without one iota of substantiated fact. What I heard recently and from opposing counsel was a lot of outrage and a lot of things happened. But the one thing I did not hear from opposing counsel was what was ruled on that was so improper. What document, what bias can you actually point to in this case? And the reason that I say that is one of the things that counsel just said was, well, we didn't know about this potential bias until we got onto the case. There have been three petitions filed in this case. And we have to also ask, and let me explain the three petitions. The first one, a pro per petition that the defendant himself filed. Mr. Mueller was representing him on the direct appeal at that time. At the same exact time, Judge Leavitt says, you have a pending appeal. I will absolutely rule on this petition if you would like me to, but I think it's best that you wait. Your counsel doesn't want me to do this right now, or at least your counsel on appeal. You're representing yourself. Do you want an attorney for your petition? The court is trying to do everything to save the defendant from himself. But sometimes the court can't do that. Petitioner says, I want to go forward with it. Judge Leavitt listens to arguments and denies the petition. The problem that I have with what opposing counsel just said then is after that petition gets denied, that's when the direct appeal gets filed. And it's only through the direct appeal that Judge Leavitt recuses herself from anything. Why does she do that? Because Attorney Mueller says he had never read the brief that got filed, and in that brief, he makes personal allegations against Judge Leavitt's daughter. Again, not tying anything to the case, just throwing out an allegation as if that's okay. It's only at that time that Judge Leavitt decides that she's going to recuse herself from Attorney Mueller's cases. Not from this individual who did not try the trial. Mr. Mueller was not the trial attorney here. The defendant had represented himself and already had a petition denied. Right after Judge Leavitt had an issue with the appeal, a second petition gets filed, not with counsel. Marlon Brown, the petitioner, files a second petition on his own. And along with that petition, he files a motion to recuse Judge Leavitt. This is in 2019. That is what the record is. He raises this then, and that is when the first of many affidavits that Judge Leavitt has filed in this case gets filed. Why? Because the defendant himself, relying upon a Baltimore Post-Examiner article, whatever that is, along with the Nevada Current article, again, not tying anything to Judge Leavitt, relies upon that and argues that she should be recused from this case. But
Mr. Chan, I want to just jump in because on the timing and where we find ourselves, the recusal motion in the writ, in the habeas corpus, in this case, was filed July 19th. There was a subsequent recusal motion filed August 2nd in the criminal case. So the first one is in this writ proceeding. If I understand the timing, which gets confused between them, right before this recusal order in the writ case, the judge had orally ruled on how she was going to come out on the writ. She's going to deny the writ. And some of that, as you've mentioned, at the defendant's instigation. He seems he wanted to get the federal court, whatever, hurry up and get it done despite advice. After that recusal and before Judge Villani unrecuses her, and I don't understand all the machinations, and I don't think they're in the record about how that got there, she files the order of denial. What effect is this court to give to a recused judge entering an order while they're recused? So if that's a problem, how do the other dominoes fall, which are all based on the fact that this decision that happened during the recusal happens? I'm sorry that question's a mess, but I think you understand
what I'm talking. I understand what you're saying, and I think that the difference here is when you objectively look at the facts, we see that there should have been no recusal filed in the habeas case. And I think that every court that has reviewed it, meaning the Jessica Villani at the time and then Chief Judge Bell at the time, have all looked at it and said, look, this was all an error. And Judge Leavitt has sworn under an affidavit that she can be fair. This was a simple mistake. Mistakes happen, and I don't think that in this one we can see any prejudice from the mistake because, again, they haven't pointed to anything. They haven't pointed to any type of bias. So a mistaken recusal occurs, but then when we look at it, it was clearly, to your example, a John Doe, that wasn't the actual John Doe.
But we do have here, there's two cases. So in one, she's continued to be recused, same person. And it's a civil proceeding, but it's a quasi-criminal proceeding. She now is unrecused. How do we deal with that, too, when we're trying to look at this objectively?
Well, I know that habeas is special in terms of, like you're saying, there's a civil case because it's a civil proceeding, but you have a criminal case number. I think the difference, though, is this isn't an instance where the reason for her recusal was based upon anything that happened in the criminal case. The criminal case is the criminal case. It was tried by eventually two public defenders, and it was given to Judge Leavitt as part of the overflow calendar. There's nothing about the reason that she ultimately recuses, which is Attorney Mueller, that has anything to do with her criminal.
But we recognize, I mean, it was only within the last 6-7 years that writ proceedings became civil proceedings with separate case numbers. They always stemmed from the criminal case and were part and parcel of it. So, as Judge Stiglitz was alluding to, got a bit of a problem with this idea of a partial recusal by a judge. The Ninth Circuit has kind of said, look, when a judge recuses, you don't get to decide what subject matter or issues you're recusing off of. A recusal is a recusal. So to the extent she's saying, I have problems with your attorney that's representing you, Mr. Brown, and saying horrible things about me and my daughter and direct appeal, you know, briefing issues, the idea of the appearance of impropriety is that that would trickle down upon the defendant in some fashion. So is it really fair to say you can recuse off that aspect, the direct appeal, but hey, I can still rule on your stuff over here, Mr. Proper defendant, because I can kind of wall your attorney off from that? I mean, it's still, they're kind of part and parcel of the same thing.
But I absolutely do think it's possible, Justice Herndon, and I know we cite a City of Las Vegas downtown redevelopment case, the one with Judge Detton. And take that case, for example. Judge Detton voluntarily recuses himself because he's worried about the potential that someone can make an allegation that because he received a campaign contribution that he couldn't be fair. Right? He voluntarily recused himself, and the Supreme Court said, we appreciate you trying to do your best job and to recuse yourself. However, you need to go back and try that case because under the judicial canons and everything else, you have a responsibility to that case. Now imagine if you're opposing counsel in that case. You have just Judge Herb Detton, who's already said that he is going to send the case away and now is going to rule on the case. So I think that it is possible to parse out these things.
Right, but nobody's saying, Judge Leavitt, you were wrong. You didn't need to recuse off that criminal case. You don't have a bias or an issue there, like was done with Judge Detton. Correct. We're saying, and apparently Judge Leavitt still feels, because she put that in her affidavit that she recused and stayed off of that, that there was an issue that prohibited her from continuing on in the defendant's direct appeal criminal part, but just that I can stay on his post-conviction criminal part.
Yes. But whose decision is it to decide that there's a judicial conflict? That comes from that's the court's responsibility to determine whether or not they have a conflict that warrants them removing themselves from the case. Judge Leavitt, as an experienced 25-year judge, I believe, was able to look at the differences and acknowledge, I have a problem with Attorney Mueller. I do not have a problem with the defendant. I will treat the defendant fair. And that's what she says in her affidavit.
So let's credit that. And let's say, okay, it's sorted out now. During the period of recusal, would it be proper for her to be ruling on motions? Doesn't mean it's not sorted, but she recused and then she's taking action. I think we have like Depichard is a little different context. Mm-hmm. It's a motion to DQ. But still, that concept that while you have, whether it's willingly put yourself on the bench or somebody has filed a motion, during that period while it's sorted out or whatever happens, should a judge be ruling on motions or taking action in the case? That's where we are.
I think that's where the error came in, Justice Stiglitz, was that it didn't realize that it had gotten off of the case because...
Yeah.
It's conflicts sure. with Attorney Mueller, and it thought Mueller was representing him in the petition.
So but for whatever reason, we don't disagree that she is recused when she enters that order.
Yeah.
So what do we do with that now?
So I think at the end of the day, it wouldn't matter because he filed yet another petition, which she was allowed to rule on. By that point, she had been reassigned yeah. to the case. That was the second petition.
But the second petition was ruled on as being successive. Because of the first petition,
it
but that depends
well.
Then if the first petition is void or not, right? It's confusing. I appreciate.
That's fair, but I think there were other issues that were raised again
sure.
substantively, and I believe that they were addressed, as well as, okay, let's forget that he even signed the second petition and that was successive. Let's go to the third petition. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we're really here about, is this is the denial from a post-conviction petition in which the judge who ultimately was assigned to the case from up north decided that there was just no basis for any of this. Despite the fact that opposing counsel might truly believe the things that he's alleging, I believe the court's words were, I can't find any objective evidence that would entitle you to an evidentiary hearing based upon what you've provided me here. So even if they were wrong on the successive procedural bars, there's certainly no reason to change this case because the court went through the actual substantive claim and found that there was just no basis for anything. So I think that's where, to answer your question, where are we now? Well, there's a denied third petition, and it was denied not on just successive procedural grounds. It was also denied on the substantive grounds. And ultimately, that's really what matters is, you know, was there an actual proper basis for the court to have either ordered an evidentiary hearing or to have granted the petition for writ of habeas corpus? And there simply isn't.
So if your position is, well, I'm not going to tell you what your position is. What is the message that we send forward? When you're recused, orders that you enter during that period are void. But in this case, it's of no consequence because it was heard on the merits. Are we saying they're not void? What's the takeaway from this confluence of facts?
I think in this confluence of facts, any error was harmless. And again, I truly believe that the court had no intention of trying to rule in a case that it didn't believe it could properly rule in. I think the mistake was that because we've divided these case numbers into civil and criminal cases, that there was a mistake that happened. And my guess is partially, and this is not to blame the staff who certainly works hard, but it probably wasn't even the judge's decision ultimately. My assumption is that there was other individuals who end up doing this. And I know even in the record that counsel provides, there's emails with the clerk staff and other things. So I think the staff plays an integral role in what happens here.
So would you then say that when Judge Villani reversed the recusal, that voided the recusal such that the recusal arguably shouldn't have ever existed, so she was able to sign the order?
I believe so.
So in that situation, it sounds like you're arguing that Judge Leavitt is a de facto judge. We have some cases older that recognize de facto judges. Nobody's briefed that here, but are you familiar with those cases or that doctrine?
And I'm actually not, just on the side call, yes.
It is interesting. That if a judge, if we accept that the judge made a mistake, or the judge's staff made a mistake, or the court clerks made a mistake in applying her request to recuse in the criminal case because of Mueller and what he said or did, but not in this case, then it raises that issue that I'm raising here. It's not unusual for a judge who might say, okay, because this law firm is involved in these cases, I recuse from all these cases, and then it's later discovered that the staff made a mistake in a standing recusal order, for example, to recuse a judge when that law firm wasn't a party in the, didn't represent a party in the case. The argument that counsel's making here on behalf of Mr. Brown seems to be that any order entered in such a case would be void. I don't know that that's something we should hold. My concern in this situation is crediting Brown's argument. How do we know that it was a mistake? I'm confused about the 4-day period between the recusal and Judge Villani's order reassigning the case. How did that, I can't track that process. I don't know how it came about. At least I don't understand it. If there's something in the record, but what forms the basis for him saying this was a mistake at that point when he's entering that order?
Well, I believe Judge Leavitt filed something as well, and this is not just the, or maybe it was a minute order, I believe, that was in the record that explains that the case was assigned or was conflicted off in error. There's a minute order to the same in that, where the court basically says that. Soon thereafter, I believe, is when Justice Galani's order saying, yes, we're reassigning it to the correct department.
So what I have in front of me, and we'll go back and look, but at the appendix volume 294, there's a minute order of Judge Leavitt recusing, July 19th, 2019. And then in the same volume 298 to 299, there's a notice of department reassignment. That's Galani's order, I believe, on July 23rd. So I'm trying to understand what happened between the 19th and the 23rd. Maybe I just don't have the full record or understand it correctly, but you're saying that there is an intervening minute order that explains that the minute order recusing the judge is mistaken?
And I'm looking at my notes to see if I have a citation for that, but if not, if I have permission to file supplemental authorities, I'll absolutely point out where that is.
Okay. You're saying there is something in the record that provides a basis for Galani's determination as the presiding criminal judge to reassign the case back to the sitting trial judge.
Correct, that the recusal was done in error.
And so Brown's counsel argues also that the presiding judge of the criminal division of the Clark District Court, 8th Judicial District Court, doesn't have authority to do any of this stuff. I'm not sure I agree with him, but I don't know that it's been argued. What is the authority for Volani's order? I mean, he, as I understand the local rules here and in the second and other areas, the chief judge rules on disqualification motions. So where is the authority for Volani's order, even if we accept that as the presiding, he's going to reassign the case? I mean, my understanding of that role is it's an administrative role. So you take this case and you take that case, as opposed to ruling on substantive kinds of questions about recusal.
But I don't think that Judge Volani, and there was no hearing in front of Judge Volani, I don't believe. The fact is, Judge Volani was able to look at the minute order and the rationale and send it back exactly as what you're saying, as an administrative procedure saying was an accidental recusal, we're sending it back to the department. Who ended up making the actual substantive decision on this was the chief judge, Linda Bell.
Right. Right. But with respect to Volani's order, I'm trying to address Mr. Counsel's argument about where does it come from? What authority does it have? So if it's simply a reassignment by the presiding judge, maybe there's a basis for that. I don't know.
I think it's just an administrative thing. What if I may, with this example, the court had just accidentally put the wrong case number in terms of what it was recusing itself from?
Right.
So now a clerical error has resulted in the recusal on the case, even though there was absolutely no reason for the basis of recusal.
Mm-hmm.
I would equate it to that. In that particular case, would Judge Volani, as the chief criminal judge, be able to simply reassign the case back to where it came from? And I think so.
If there's something in the record that shows the basis for that.
Yes, and I apologize for not having that right here, but if I could, I will absolutely file
maybe
something.
Justice Stiglitz, she seems to want to weigh in on
this. I just have a question. I have is July 19th is the minute order recusing Judge Leavitt. The notice of department reassignment is unrelated to that recusal. It's the August 8th minute order that reassigns Judge Leavitt that then says for good cause appearing recusals filed in error. What I didn't see in the record, it doesn't mean it's not, I just did not see in the record, was anything that tips us off to what's the instigation for Judge Volani's change obviously something happened. They're busy, not just flipping around looking for stuff to do. Somebody said, hey, this is okay, or this is an error. And that's not in the record.
I think if you look at Judge Leavitt's affidavit, though, I mean, she covers all the bases for it as well. She says exactly what happened and exactly the rationale.
Can you give me a cite on that?
Yes, that's the 470. This is the third one that she filed. She filed quite a few.
The third
affidavit. Yes.
In the motion to DQ?
Or in correct. Yes.
But see, that's after. That's after August 8th. That's later, right? I'm talking about before August 8th.
But
what do we have? Yeah. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge. Why don't you wrap up your argument, Mr. Chin? You're significantly over time, but it's a complex problem, and I will afford you the opportunity to offer within 5 days a cite to the record. No argument, just a cite to the record that predates August 8th, that identifies the basis for Lonnie's order on that date.
Thank you.
Do you have any wrap up?
I presume
your position is that ultimately, setting aside the procedural issues, the senior judge ruled on the merits of the third petition.
Exactly. And I would hope that eventually any decision clears the district court of any wrongdoing here.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, I'm going to give
you 3 minutes of time to address your final remarks.
Okay. With regards to the good deed, the fact that she volunteered to take on this case, I think, lends credibility to the bias issue in and of itself. So addressing that argument by opposing counsel.
Let me move you over to as well a question that I had, which goes to Justice Hardesty's question about de facto judges. There's nothing that I've seen in the record or in the pleadings that in any way detracts from the court having had jurisdiction and authority to preside over the June 18th, 2019 hearing where she denied the petition, or the merits of that ruling denying the petition. The question is about when she signed the written order that memorialized that. Judges sign orders for other judges all the time, and I think that's part of the idea of de facto judges. Cases get transferred to departments. The orders come in from prior hearings. Judge signs off on those orders after staff makes sure it complies with what occurred at the hearing. So under that theory, I mean, what is the prejudice to your client that Judge Leavitt, who was a sitting district court judge at the time, signed that order?
Like I said, number one, thank you for the question, Ron. Number one, we don't know whether this was in a mistake. I mean, to be honest, we have her, you know, excuse that it was related to the counsel. But again, two cases are related. It's an appeal from a criminal case.
But to be clear, so, let me just make sure we're focused here. There's no, you're not disputing the merits of the order, that it correctly reflected what occurred when she denied the petition on June 8, 2019. You're just disputing whether she should have been able to sign it.
So when she entered that order, she was already recused on August 7th. She was, if you're talking about the unrecusal afterwards, nope. That only happened afterwards.
Just talking
afterwards.
About the written order denying the first petition.
Yes.
There doesn't appear to be any dispute that it was not in some fashion a correct order of her ruling denying the petition, which occurred on June 18th, 2019, when she presided over that hearing.
Yes. Okay. And I would note that this court's precedent is that a final disposition in an oral pronouncement of a proceeding or an admitted order is not effective until it is written.
Let me ask it a different way. Let's assume that Judge Villani or Judge Miley or Chief Judge at that time, Barker, somebody signed that order. You're not disputing that that order would have been valid.
I would dispute that because the judge who hears the proceeding would have to enter the order. And so I'm not sure that there's any kind of procedure to allow a judge who did not preside or rule on a lower court proceeding to write a order and then enter it for another judge, especially while they've been recused. I don't think that authority exists. And with regard to...
Well, you recognize that judges retire, judges leave office, judges pass away, and orders get signed that memorialize hearings that were held before those judges. So other judges can sign orders, but in any event, I'll let you keep going. I'm sorry.
Would you like me to continue on the issue of...
I'll give you a couple more minutes to finish. Yeah. Just wrap up your argument, if you would, please. I think we understand your position.
Yeah, there was a bunch of questions that you made. Regarding the unrecusal. I would note that there wasn't really an unrecusal. I mean, the lower court, or the Judge Villano, reassigned the case, but there is no order undoing that order. I mean, if she's going to unrecuse, you would expect her to enter an order saying, I'm unrecusing, but she did not do that, also did not serve the order on the client who's proceeding pro se. Mm-hmm. I think that because of that, the recusal order remains in effect. But even if the reassignment were unrecusal, the order on the petition for habeas corpus, the first one, was entered the day prior to that supposed unrecusal. And if that means it's still entered while she's recused, and because of this court's prior precedent on needing to be entered in writing, a dispositive order, especially I would also note that this court entered that exact ruling in a companion civil case that Marlin filed before this court on the issue of the bond, suing the bond company. This court said he appealed the oral pronouncement of the denial of that case, which he has now later won. And this court said it's not an appealable order because the final order is not appealable, and it is not final or effective because there was no written order on it. And so there's already that order in a case that intersects with this case, that's the case. And to consider the later order filed as potentially, or the earlier oral pronouncement of the order as final in this case, when the court has already ruled in a companion case that such orders would not be final, in my opinion, would be an arbitrary decision considering the cases are related. And with regards to that, it's just there was no final order. And if you're considering that the reassignment is an unrecusal, the first order is still filed while she's recused. And there is no order explaining that basis.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McAvoy. Maya, right?
Yes, McAvoy Maya. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your argument today, Mr. Chin. Thank you for your argument. The case will stand submitted.